Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I got a couple of extra rides in this week, so, what's not to like?
How did you do that?
Just made time.
Mm-hmm.
Just got to make time.
Yeah. What'd you do, pull like a rabbit out of a hat, and along with the rabbit came three extra hours or something?
Something like that.
Yeah. I'm not finding that extra time these
days.
No. It's crazy at the shop.
You got to get on that bike, woman.
Get on that bike, woman. All right. So the first thing I'd like to do is congratulate our friend Patrick Brady.
Okay.
It's the third anniversary of Red Kite Prayer.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
He said something very interesting. Here's what he said on that anniversary when he launched his project. He said, "My ambition, modest as it was to have the ability to write about cycling without the influence of a publisher or advertisers who think the good editorial can be purchased. I also thought that I could manage to get paid something for this work by selling some advertising to builders and companies who trusted me enough not to interfere with my work. I never thought RKP would be particularly sizable. Here's my answer to that. Ha, 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 ha."
Good
so,
for him.
Big shout out to RKP.
Yeah.
Red Kite Prayer. I think it's great, and he should keep up the good work. His, by the way, the whole post, if you go to RKP, and I think it just talks about his third anniversary, I thought that would really be cool. So I would like to report on the tour, but there's way too much to say. I'd love to be able to just be so smart and tell you everything I think. I'm not Bob Roll, number one. I'm certainly not Mr. Sherwin or Mr. Liggett. So I think the listeners can figure out what they want about the tour. I do have a comment, and that I think that the media should let the riders ride and stop accusing, whispering, and making up stories about people. I think it's just rude and obnoxious. I know it's sensationalism, and maybe they're doping, and maybe... Just let them ride. Why can't you just report on the tour? It's very exciting this year. Uh-oh. Here it comes. Let me hear it.
You know what you're also doing whenever you're watching the tour on television, Diane?
What?
Sitting.
Not necessarily. Not me.
No?
No.
Okay, most people.
I have it on, but I don't just stare at it for 3 hours.
Okay.
You mean as opposed to being out on my bike riding?
Well, sitting will take 3 years off your life, even if you exercise a lot. So,
yes, I know.
So I'm just saying. Just saying.
All right.
And I'm actually going to follow the tour in August or September or October.
You mean after the fact?
When the real winner's announced.
Oh, gee.
Once they get all the blood and the urine sorted out and they figure out, who was really supposed to be there and who wasn't, then I'll cheer for the eventual winner.
Okay. All right. No argument there, I guess. You mean rah-rah, your little pom-poms and stuff.
I just have to be a smart ass.
Yes, that's true. What else is new? So our velodrome, you've been watching?
I've been seeing the pictures, yeah.
They're putting stripes on it now.
You got the lines going.
Yeah, the lines are coming up. It's so interesting to me because I always know if you think something's going to take 3 months, add 2 months to it. I mean, there's just no way things get done when you think they're going to get done.
Unless you have seen a track like that being built, and I never have, I don't think anybody has a concept of what is involved.
Exactly.
It's a real involved process.
It is.
I mean, it looks just like steel and aluminum and wood, but...
It is.
It's pretty complex.
Until you try to put it all together in something called a 166-meter track.
Yeah.
There was a video of two riders on it at once this week. That was kind of cool.
Yeah.
So we have a big show this week.
Mm-hmm.
It's very wide-ranging. We're going to have three guests. First up is Carolyn Sapansky. She works in Washington, D.C. at the League of American Bicyclists, and she's the point person for the first National Women's Bicycle Summit in Long Beach this fall. So the summit hopes to bring together a wide range of ideas, projects, and people to further the involvement of women in every facet of bicycling. So I think it's going to be interesting to talk with her. Then we're going to head over to Indiana and talk with Jim Schroeder. Jim is the ride director for Indiana's Rain Ride. Did you ever do it?
No, but I've heard about it.
So it's 160 miles in one day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful, evidently rural Indiana roadways. They're very nice and clean, but it's 160 miles in one day. And it's if you do it the same time as Rainstorm, which is a week of century rides,
mm-hmm.
it's the seventh day, which means you've done 6 days of 100 miles a day, and then you're going to do the seventh day as 160 miles. Well, we'll find out. It's a big ride, though. 1,500 to 1,600 riders
wow.
ride rain. Rainstorm, they have a very
small number.
Yeah, 40, yeah. 50 riders.
You know what Rainstorm stands for?
Ride Across Indiana. Oh.
Rainstorm is rain, same thing, only ride more.
Seriously.
No, I'm serious.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense.
And rain is right across Indiana.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like rag bry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, the last person we're going to speak with is Jason Shires of Envy.
Ah, the composite people.
Aha. Yes. Now, Envy used to be Edge. I met Jason at press camp, and he walked me through the history of Envy and some of the work they're doing. And I think you'll enjoy some of the behind-the-scenes things that are going on there. They are an American company making product in the U.S. and supplying product to a hell of a lot of companies all over the world. So that's kind of refreshing for a change.
Sweet.
Yeah. And we've got news.
Okay.
Some of it tour, some of it not. And we'll talk some more. So
okay.
You want to get started?
Yes.
All right. Carolyn Sapansky from the League of American Bicyclists. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
I wanted to touch base with you when I read about the National Women's Bike Summit coming up in September. What is the purpose of this summit?
Well, as you probably know, being out there on the street, women are actually fairly dramatically underrepresented in American cycling. One statistic that we cite fairly regularly is that in 2009, women only accounted for 24% of all bike trips in the United States. So we have a lot of work to get up to gender parity, to, you know, be like a country like the Netherlands where, you know, more than 50% of bike trips are taken by women, and cycling is seen as a mode of transportation that's safe and accessible and inviting to everyone in our community, not just men. So I actually looked in Cleveland, according to 2010 data, only 28% of bicycle commuters were women. So basically the purpose of this summit is to elevate the conversation about how do we change those numbers? How do we make it so, like I said, we have more women who feel safe out riding on our streets, and also how do we encourage women to be in leadership positions in this movement, whether that's, being on a bicycle and pedestrian advisory committee, whether that's being in a leadership position with their local advocacy organization, or, feeling, inclined to maybe get a job in a bike shop. So how do we make women feel comfortable and invited in all aspects of bicycling? So this summit is an opportunity to bring folks together from all around the country who are doing work in all these different areas, whether it's in retail, whether it's in racing, whether it's in advocacy, and kind of share the best practices of, what's going on in all these local communities that's being successful in engaging women. So,
well, it's interesting that you talk about retail. Well, obviously, I'm in retail. I've been a women bike shop owner for almost 40 years, and now the chatter is changing. Finally,
yeah.
And women are often intimidated. It's what I've heard my entire career. Women are afraid to go into bike shops, and I think that's changing. So
yeah.
Where is the summit being held and when?
It's going to be September 13th in Long Beach, California at the Long Beach Convention Center, which is just, 25 miles or so south of Los Angeles.
That's really cool. How many people do you think are you hoping to get?
Well, we're hoping to. We organized a National Women's Cycling Forum at the National Bike Summit this year, and in very short order, we had 200 people sign up just in a matter of a couple of weeks. So we're hoping to accommodate at least 300 up to 350 people, and we're fairly confident that there will be the interest there to fill all the seats yet again.
So is this going to be in a conference kind of setting? Are there going to be booths? Are there going to be, I guess I'm not quite understanding what the summit is going to be. Is it going to be breakout sessions like we do
yeah.
at the summit in D.C.?
Yes, exactly. So we're going to open with an inspiring keynote address from Leah Misbach-Day, who's the co-founder of World Bicycle Relief, who will talk a little bit about her work empowering women worldwide by providing bicycles to women and girls in developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to break up into two sets of breakout sessions. So there'll be six breakout sessions overall dealing and there'll be panels talking about and dealing with issues like how do we engage young girls and youth engagement? How do we, you know, come up with marketing messages and utilize media more effectively to get the word out to women? And how do we do outreach to communities that, you know, maybe aren't the traditional demographic of what we perceive, you know, cyclists or bicycle advocates to be? So how do we bring more people into movement? So we'll have six sessions like that. And then in the evening, there's going to be a Cycle Chic fashion show, which is going to be the first Cycle Chic fashion show in Southern California, I'm told. So we'll have a little bit of time to kind of celebrate the intersection of style and advocacy, and also, you know, mix and mingle it and have more time to network and talk. And then after that, we'll have a little bit of an after party to kind of continue the discussions and continue the networking.
So it's a one-day event.
Yes.
Okay. And is attendance limited only to women?
No, absolutely not. Though we are, most of the speakers and the folks who will be presenting, well, actually 100% will be women, kind of based on the fact that a lot of us go to these conferences and we do see a lot of men being the presenter. So we really want this to be a forum for women to share their experiences and kind of find their voices.
Well, it sounds very interesting. It's a lot of traveling in September for people in the bike business because Interbike
yeah.
doesn't show up until the following week.
Yep.
So, but you have me very intrigued. It's a
yeah.
place I feel like I should be. And you do not have to be part of the industry today to go to the summit, I would take it. You could just be.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
You can just be someone who's a bicyclist, someone who's interested in bicycling, someone who's interested in, you know, women's empowerment even. So, yeah.
Why don't you direct our listeners to where they can get information if they're interested in attending and or finding out about it to maybe, you know, either give something to it or take something from it?
Yeah, exactly. So you can find more information on our website, which is bikeleague.org/conferences/women.
We'll post a link to that on WJCU's Outspoken Cyclist page too. So,
yeah, and in addition, if folks are interested in contributing to this effort to elevating the conversation about women in cycling and empowering and moving this forward, we also have a page where people can donate either to, you know, the scholarship fund. We're going to be giving some scholarships and travel stipends to women who may not have the financial means to get to Long Beach, and then also to continue this work after the summit and plan future events and you know, combine resources and things of that nature. So if folks are interested in that, the website is razoo.com/womenbike, razoo.com.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool. So who came up with this idea?
It kind of originated in 2010 at the Alliance for Biking and Walking Leadership
right.
Retreat. There was a gathering of women who got together and started discussing these ideas. And then the first real tangible event that happened was, like I said, this past March, the Women's Cycling Forum at the National Bike Summit. And the response was just phenomenal that we knew we had to continue and have another event that was, you know, longer and provided the venue for more discussion. So, again, this is just our second step. We're going to continue this forward after that even. So,
well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me this evening about the Women's Bike Summit in September. And one way or another, I'll either see you there or I'll probably see you at the Bike Summit for sure in Washington next March. So thanks
Wonderful.
So much.
Thank you.
Have a great evening.
You too.
All right, Carolyn. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Carolyn Sapansky joined us from the League of American Bicyclists office in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And in a few months, she'll be headed out to Long Beach, California for
Evidently.
The Women's Bike Summit.
Yep.
Sounds exciting.
I think it is exciting. I'm wondering what's going to come out of it. And I think you don't have to be just a woman to be interested in it. In fact, I think bike shop owners who are looking to find women to work in their shops, because I hear that a lot, might find that this is a good place to learn how to get them to come.
Whether they're looking for women employees or not, I think it would be a good thing for a bike shop owner to just understand that particular segment of the market better.
I do too.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that this is an environment they might feel more comfortable doing it. The NBDA, the National Bicycle Dealers Association, talks about this a lot, but they're not doing this kind of in-depth sort of look at it. So I'm excited. I think it's a good idea.
There you go.
All right.
Hey, I'm excited to hear from this next guest because...
Are you?
Yes, because...
this is right up your alley.
Yeah, of course, of course. So where are we going? We're going one state over, right?
We are. Well, one state from us.
Yeah.
Not from Washington.
Right.
Right. We are going over to Indiana to speak with Jim Schroeder, who is the director of the RAIN Ride, Ride Across Indiana. Jim, thanks for joining us on the Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
Glad to be here. I've been a listener, and I enjoy your show. I enjoy your participants and everything. It's a great show.
Thank you. We love listeners. So you are the ride director for the RAIN Ride.
That's right.
Right across Indiana.
Right across Indiana. For the last 24 years, it's gone along essentially the national road, which is U.S. 40, going from Terre Haute to Richmond. And it's usually somewhere in the neighborhood of 160 miles, depending on road closures and how we go around Indianapolis. We don't go through Indianapolis. We go south of Indianapolis, and everything depends on the road construction.
So RAIN is a long one-day ride, 160 miles in one day.
We call it one day, one way.
One day, one way, point A to point B. How many stops do you have along the way?
We have 5 rest stops, one of those being lunch, about halfway in between, at like around mile 87. And then another rest stop before you get back on the U.S. 40 east of Indianapolis is a ice and drink stop, and that's usually the hottest part of the ride, about, 3 o'clock in the afternoon for most of the riders, and the asphalt is radiating. So they enjoy the ice.
I would guess.
Ice. Yes.
Do you ever spray them down with a hose?
A lot of owners, property owners will put their hoses out there.
That's nice.
I fully enjoy. Yeah, ice water thrown at you by your SAG vehicle is great.
How many SAGs are on the road with these guys?
Well, actually, it's really hard to do it from an organization standpoint, so we encourage personal support vehicles.
Ah.
I would say one out of every 3 or 4 riders have one. We officially don't have SAG vehicles because it's not a loop ride. It's from one end to the other.
Right.
So it's really difficult. We have the 5 food stops about every 25 to 30 miles. The first one being at 38 miles because it's still fairly cool and everyone's all pumped up. So they have no problem doing the first 40 miles. But we try to tell all the personal support vehicles to adopt other people. If they see people having a flat or something like that, stop by and help them out because, you've probably been on a ride too where you need help and no one's there, and it's always great when a motorist stops and helps you out. So.
Well, owning a bike shop, everybody wants us to help them, so.
That's right.
We know how that is.
Yeah, we do have a couple bike shops pretty much on the route.
Oh, good.
So they help out, but I know I've sagged a couple times because I've been injured a couple times, and I always have a support vehicle. And you really don't need a support vehicle, but if you really want a good time, you don't want to waste time sometimes at the food stops. It's the rider's choice. Lots of times, personal support vehicles will hang out at the rest stops also. The one thing that we try to make sure is that the personal support vehicles do not ride or don't drive on the route that goes south of Indianapolis because it's on smaller roads. And we're already adding 1,500 bicyclists to the mix of Saturday morning traffic in suburbia. We really don't need 500 more cars.
Right. So they have a parallel route that they can go?
Yeah, they have a designated route, pretty much the interstates that go around Indianapolis, right. And then they meet. They go on their own route at Plainfield, which is west of Indianapolis, and then they meet back with the riders. We let them go meet them at lunch, and then they meet back with the riders in Greenfield, and then they can ride. They can drive US 40 along with the riders. We don't allow motor pacing.
Oh, good.
We don't allow food handoffs, you know, while they're driving.
Right.
That's little dangerous. It's not quite the Tour de France.
No, it's not. I would imagine not. So do riders come from all over to do this event?
Oh, yeah. We've had riders, I think, from pretty much every state. A lot of them, went to school at IU or have some friends in Indiana. But it's a great feeling to cross a state in one day. I know Ohio is a little too wide for most people, although I do know a few riders that have crossed Ohio in one day.
Probably riders.
Yeah, the Ram riders. But 150 miles is manageable for most of your riders that, try to do centuries. And I always tell, I tell people that it's pretty much the introduction to ultra riding. Once you do the 160 across Indiana, you start thinking, hey, maybe I can do a double century. And then after that, hey, maybe I can do the National 24 and things like that. I mean, that's how I got into ultra racing. So.
And then it's Paris-Roubaix. Not Paris-Roubaix. Yeah, it's Paris-Brest-Paris.
Paris-Creek. Yeah, and all that.
Right.
Stuff.
Paris-Brest-Paris, 700.
Yeah. Montreal or Boston. Montreal-Boston. Yeah,
so
you're right.
So why don't you tell our listeners, first of all, you are still taking registrations, yes?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
There is a website. It's rainride.org.
Okay.
And we still accept registrations up until the evening before.
Wow, you're brave.
Probably if you're going to be there the evening before, don't use the website. Just show up at our registration, and you can register the day before.
Wow.
And we're open at 4 o'clock to 10 o'clock the evening before at our start area, which is St. Mary's of the Woods College, which is in West Terre Haute. We don't quite start at the Illinois state line, but about 2 miles east of the Illinois state line. We started that venue last year, and it's worked out pretty good. Last year was a completely new all-volunteer staff from our club organized it all ourselves, and we thought starting it at a nice small college with a great campus would be nice for the participants, and we also have dormitories that actually are all booked since April, but most of the people come in that morning. They stay at the hotels in Terre Haute.
Got it. Well, I hope you have great weather this year, as in 70 degrees and sunny. Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be great, yeah. 70 degrees, maybe even 80 degrees would be a little cool. But,
yeah.
yeah, with a tailwind. I mean, I think of the 26 years, we have only had a true tailwind twice.
Yes, we understand. We live in Ohio on the lake where regardless of the direction you go, it's always a headwind.
I remember doing a tassel ride. Do you remember tassel?
Sure, absolutely.
Many, many years ago.
Many, many years ago. The tour along the south shore of Lake Erie.
Yes, it was great going to Cleveland. Coming back, they had gale force winds from the west.
Yes, of course we did.
Yeah.
Welcome to Cleveland. If you don't like the weather, wait a minute.
Wait a minute. You're right.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for talking to us on the show this evening. Good luck with the ride this year.
Okay.
And take care. All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jim Schroeder joined us from Bloomington, Indiana, where he's getting ready to...
Rain.
Rain. I don't think it's going to rain on the rain ride this year.
No, he wishes it would rain. I think we'd all wish for a little gentle rain. Yeah. That would be nice.
You know, rain is the gateway drug to ultramarathon cycling.
Interesting. So you haven't done it yet.
That one's got to be on my bucket list.
I hope so.
I didn't think Indiana was that narrow. I thought for sure it was more than 160 miles across. But
evidently, it's 162. They start 2 miles in.
Okay.
I'm just messing with you.
I thought it was a wider state than that. So that's very doable. That's very doable. And in
the
middle of the summer.
Well, especially for you.
Well, no, I think anybody who can ride a century could ride that. And it's not real hilly. It's not like Ohio. You're going to cross Ohio.
No, he
you
says
have
it's gentle rolling hills, and I'm sure
gentle
it's pretty.
Rolling, yeah. You know, you've got plenty of daylight this time of year.
And Indiana does daylight savings time, do they?
They do not.
They just hang out with Eastern time. So.
But you still have the same amount of daylight.
You would think so.
As Ohio. The sun, no.
The sun also, no. You're a little further west.
It has to do with the latitude, not the longitude, Diane. It shines for the same number of hours in Indiana as it does Ohio.
Okay.
Trust me.
I do trust you.
Okay. You can ask Brian about it later.
Hey, I'm not
an
astronomer. What can I tell you? I'm really good at bikes, though.
We'll give you that.
Thank you.
Okay.
I could use it.
On that note, we better take a break and go look up, Google the...
Google the time change?
Yes.
I'm just messing with you.
We better go Google some astronomy facts.
All right.
But we'll be back with news and more on The Outspoken Cyclist right after this.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Tuesday, July 22nd, you can learn that every plant has a purpose and a story at the South Euclid Garden Club's Heritage Interpretive Program at the Community Center on Victory Drive in South Euclid. Join Mr. Foster Brown at 6:30 p.m. as he plays the role of Dr. Wildweed, an old-time herbalist who deals with common health concerns using a mix of familiar wild herbs and humor. Fiddle playing, storytelling, and audience participation are all part of this free public event, produced in cooperation with Cleveland Metro Parks.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we've got time to squeeze in a little bit more news here.
Yes, we do.
Okay, what do you got for us?
Well, you know, some of the excitement of the tour this week has been muffled by all these accusations that Wiggins can't be doing what he's doing without doping. So it really upset me, and I know it upset him. Regardless of the side, though, that you come down on about doping, Armstrong... versus the USADA, you know that his suit was thrown out by the judge.
And then he immediately refiled it.
Well, they had to change some things. It was an 80-page brief, you know. It has to be succinct, and I doubt if it was succinct. There were a lot of things about it.
Yeah.
But according to Maureen Weston, who's a Pepperdine University law professor and an expert on arbitration and sports law, this doesn't seem to be the purpose of the USADA to get involved in criminal investigations. The feds went through an extensive investigation, and it was dropped. The concern that I now have is the use of that evidence in this action. It's about the relationship of the USADA to the federal government, and Ms. Weston doesn't like it. She goes on to describe the USADA's relationship to the federal government as Orwellian, because the USADA acts like government, works like government, has harnessed the powers of government, and yet it's a private corporation. Now, I know you have something to say about that.
Well, I'm no lawyer, so she's got more knowledge on the subject than I do. But on the surface of it, it seems like there is a distinction in that everybody in the U.S. is subject to the laws of the U.S.
Right.
We live under the rule of law. But people who race bikes professionally submit voluntarily to the rules of the USADA and the USA Cycling and UCI. It's almost like workplace rules. So, and when Lance Armstrong decided to race a bike as a professional, he sort of bought into the USADA and their jurisdiction and their rules and everything. And so I don't see a problem with them doing what they're doing because it's...
It's about using the evidence, though, in a criminal investigation and not allowing him to have any, you know, any...
But they're not pursuing a criminal investigation. They're pursuing an action that will result, if they are successful, what would be the outcome? It'll result in some sort of a sanction or ban.
True, against him.
But they're not talking about putting him in jail or finding him.
Well, they're sort of hamstringing him professionally.
Again, that's when I go to work for a company, they have a handbook, and I have to sign that I agree to abide by all these rules.
Yes.
I have the option not to work there. If I don't like some of the rules that they put in place for their workplace, I can say, no, thank you. I'll go to work for this other company because I like their rules better. It's an option I have. But once I sign up for that, I have to abide by them. I can't say, oh, no, now I don't like those rules.
Remember, there was a treaty, though, involved, too. There was a worldwide treaty that was signed by the U.S. about doping.
Yeah.
That sort of spawned the whole ADA thing. I don't know. I guess what I don't like is that here they found nothing, at least the criminal investigation found nothing, and yet they're using all this stuff again to do the same thing. How are they not going to come up with the same?
Well, they have a little bit more now, I think, because
some people have said that they're going to talk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
and three people with medical licenses in Europe, Dr. Ferrari. I hate to even call them doctors because
yeah, really.
What they do isn't medicine.
No.
But let's say the people who have MD after their names took a look at what they thought they had and who they were talking to and said, we really don't want to even go through this process. We'll just take the lifetime ban, thanks.
That's true.
And wouldn't you think that...
Who knows? Yeah, I mean, it's really bizarre. The whole thing's pretty bizarre.
Who knows what their real motivation was for taking that, but I got to believe that they saw the writing on the wall
and just said, never mind.
We're bailing. And the other thing is that... who is it? Hincapie, Leipheimer, and Zabriskie all specifically requested not to be on the U.S. Olympic team.
Yes.
There's a lot of...
I know. Funny stuff going on.
Intrigue going on here that
Yeah, somebody needs to do a movie or a book.
Well, and for somebody who says that they are the most tested athlete in history and that they've never failed a drug test, there's a lot of protesting going on.
I know.
You know,
well,
Armstrong thought that he could win this case on the merits, why is he trying to just cut it off at the pass?
Well, I don't know. I think he's tired of it, number one. But one thing I came away with from this big, this was a big, by the way, we are discussing an article, which I didn't say at the outset, that was in Outside Magazine Online by, I think, Brian Alexander. Mm-hmm. And it's an excellent article. It's lengthy. It was like six, you know, you had to go forward six pages on the web.
Six
web pages.
Yeah.
But, well, with all kinds of stuff around it. But I found it a very interesting article. And it was, I think it's a huge can of worms. The treaty that was signed, you know, gives the USADA powers way beyond our Constitution, I think, in some ways. But it might bring a level playing field after all this. I wouldn't mind that happening.
Almost every workplace rule that you can name has more power and less protection than our Constitution gives us.
Yeah, I guess.
And I don't see it as anything different than that. But again, I'm not a lawyer. The article is interesting. Recommended reading, whether you agree with it or not.
Right, exactly. Can we move on?
Please.
All right, this is tour-related, but not tour-related.
Okay.
Fabian Cancellara, left. He left the tour. He was in yellow for 7 days. He won a stage. He's also a husband and a father. And this week is the imminent birth of his second child. Here's what he said. This is from cyclingnews.com. Cancellara withdraws. I am not only a biker, I am also a husband and father with another baby on the way. It is my personal wish to be present when my wife Stephanie gives birth to our second child. That trophy is more important than another tour stage win or an Olympic medal. I already need to thank my wife for her patience with me during the last month in her pregnancy that has been difficult at times. The least I can do is assist her in these difficult days, he said. I thought that that was very nice.
Good for him.
He rode for a week and he said, you know what? This baby's coming now. I don't know what the problems were in the last month, but hey, I'm very pleased.
There's a guy who has his priorities in the right order.
Yes, I think so too. Yeah. Our last one this evening is about taking a sub-24-hour tour. Remember Grant Peterson talking about, going on an overnight?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Adventure Cyclist Magazine sort of has been publishing people's overnights as stories. And there's also a website called bikeovernights.org. And the story that they published this past month is by a woman named Louise Kornreich, and it's entitled Overnight Escape from Seattle. Here's a short excerpt. It was such a cool story. After reading about bike overnights and S240s on the Adventure Cycling blog, my friend Todd and I dreamed up a way to take a midweek break to an island while not having to take any vacation time from work, Louise writes. We would ride to work with our bikes fully loaded for a night of camping, slave all day at our desks, or not, and ride down to the Seattle ferry dock to depart for Bainbridge Island in the early evening. That's exactly what they did. Once on the island, they loaded up at a grocery store, headed to Fay Bainbridge Park, which mostly hugs the shores of Puget Sound and allows for many views to the north, like Mount Baker and east, the Cascade Range. At the park, they cooked dinner, watched the moon rise over Mount Rainier, set up their tents at a site right near the beach, and the next morning, after watching the sunrise, had a quick snack, packed up, headed back to town. And while the area's commuters were queuing up for the ferry, we lingered over breakfast, rolled down the ramp, onto the waiting boat, and headed back to the city. Although it was another day of work we were headed to, our close-in adventure made us feel like we had been on vacation.
Hmm.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
And you can read the rest of Louise's story and many more at bikeovernights.org.
Okay, and then with that, we move along?
We do.
We're going to talk about carbon fiber.
We do. I met Jason Shears at Press Camp. He is the owner and the chief head guy at Envy Composites. He's in Ogden, Utah. Jason, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to talk about carbon fiber. And Envy, which is your company, is all about carbon. You want to give us a little bit of background like you did at Press Camp for me about Envy, like when it began and where you're located and who you are?
Sure, absolutely. So Envy was started in 2005 as Edge Composites, and we're located in Ogden, Utah. And essentially, we've been building bike parts under the branded name of Edge since 2008. And, of course, in 2010, the end of 2010, we had to change to Envy due to a trademark issue. But I think most people are getting to know us as Envy now. And, of course, my name is Jason Shears, and I started the company and was responsible for a lot of the early stuff. But I've been fortunate enough to be joined by a lot of smart people, so we're just kind of a collection of cyclists that want to build the best possible products that one would want to ride.
Well, I think you have somewhat of a unique story because you make your products here in the States, yes?
Absolutely. We're as proud of that and as interested in promoting that as we are the product itself. And so we're kind of unique because we're kind of almost a self-contained facility as far as we've got our own machining equipment for tooling. And so we can basically start with a model and do everything we need to do all the way through a production piece of tooling in-house. So it's not just even just a composite shop. It's kind of an all-encompassing manufacturing center.
Well, your website's very comprehensive. So, when we're all done, we'll talk about the website so people can kind of get a better feel visually for what Envy's doing, which is a lot of stuff. So how are you competitive in such a, and I don't want to use the word foreign incorrectly, but sort of a foreign marketing environment where so much stuff is coming from the Orient and being sold here in carbon fiber?
Yeah, well, I think some of it's just timing, and we were lucky. Most of the bike companies that exist all started here at one point, and then as through growth and whatever, have used Asia as a way to you know, to continue to grow their manufacturing. But so we were lucky. We started kind of late in that cycle as far as Asia goes. But we've seen, you know, cost increases between 8 and 12% consistently for the last 4 years out of Asia. So I guess where the luck of timing for us came in is we still hadn't completely transferred our production to Asia. And so we still had a substantial footprint here making things in the U.S. And it, you know, just reinforced the idea that we should stay here rather than go there. Where a lot of people have moved over there completely and they're, you know, now serving more of a marketing role. So it was very fortunate for us. Asia is not as good a deal as it used to be.
Yeah, and part of that is freight, I would imagine, too, just the cost of getting goods from Asia to the U.S.
Logistical costs go way up, and then there's all the logistical issues that you have, which, you know, you've got long lead times and you have to buy large bulk, you know, shipments. And so there's a fairly substantial, you know, inventory savings cost and whatnot for us to manufacture here in the States and kind of make to order. So there's a lot of efficiencies we're gaining by not dealing with you know, the logistical issues of somebody on the other side of the ocean.
Well, and that brings up something I didn't think of before, and that is the warranty issue. So you could handle a warranty, like, pretty much instantly if there was a problem.
Yeah, in fact, you know, for us, we just recently moved to a five-year warranty, and the reason for that is we've had 5 years worth of product use now. So we felt like we could make that move to 5 years pretty confidently, just because we have a history now showing that the product isn't susceptible to anything before 5 years. So when we do get a few back, and they are very few, but when we do get them back, our lead times have been cut to about 48 hours from the time we receive the wheel to the time it's on its way back to the consumer. So it's not only that we can handle them ourselves, we can handle them really fast.
Well, and that's an interesting point, the whole idea of just in time, that you don't have to have thousands and thousands of pieces of any SKU in stock in your warehouse, that you're sort of keeping up on a day-to-day or a week-to-week or month-to-month basis.
In moments has its issues, and some of our customers would explain that because they have to wait a little longer sometimes. But, I mean, we generally are able to operate within a couple weeks delivery, and usually, you know, purchase of this size, somebody's done their research and they're pretty much set on what they're going to get. So a little patience is there, but, you know, it's something that we're trying to get better at all the time as far as delivery, which is one of the advantages of carrying a large inventory. But
we're talking two different, but we're also talking two different customers for you. You have a consumer, so my end customer who's actually riding it, but you also have builders who are building with your carbon.
Yeah, you know, and one of the unique things about our product is it's pretty easy for any builder to build it, due to how we process and mold the product, because we mold the spokels in, which gives the product a much more robust fill and spoke face when you're building it. And so, you know, any builder that's built them has always come back to us and said, you know, it's a great product to build, but there's not the liability that there used to be with having to give it to an approved builder. So we sell a lot of hoop only. And then allows the customer to get whatever hub and spoke they want, which is kind of nice and versatile at that level to have some customization.
Well, that's your wheels, but you also make other things. And I do want to talk about wheels. I know that wheels are probably a bigger part of your business almost than anything, but are you also making any kind of tubing? What are you supplying to people like Parley and Calfee and IF and Ericsson and Crisp?
Sure. Well, that's part of our business. It's not quite as promoted. We're very, you know, when we started the business, it was important to me that we establish relationships with a lot of those guys. I'd known a lot of those guys from the years I'd been with other companies prior, and I knew that there was kind of a need there that wasn't being filled as far as, you know, addressing a level of customization for those guys and doing it in smaller part runs, which, in, you know, obviously American manufacturing allows us to do it in smaller part runs and still do it somewhat efficiently. And so we kind of established these relationships with all the small builders. And that's why when you go to NABS or something like that, where all the small builders show up, that you see so much Envy product, because most of those relationships are something that we've been working on since 2006 and trying to service and give those guys some technological advantages, you know, that they didn't have before as far as being able to build with carbon tubes and lugs and stays. So.
Well, one of the things I've noticed as a bike shop is that all of a sudden, Envy forks are everywhere, where before we were looking at like Alpha Q, we were looking at, you know, different forks. But For example, Craig Calfee specs Envy Forks. And they're they're beautiful. We really like them. Well, of course, that I'm punching your product up here. Meanwhile,
well, I mean, it's because it's the sickest fork ever. But no, we do things a little differently in how we mold, and so our fork's a great example of that. You know, whereas historically people would use a pre-cured steer tube and cure the legs over a pre-cured steer tube, and then cut the ends and bond in the dropouts, and there was all these, you know, different issues with manufacturing and secondary process. And we went in and molded it in one piece, and it comes out of the tool in one piece. And so, essentially, you know, whereas other forks had wasted weight in filler material for drill and break holes or bond layers, you know, we have a very efficient structure. It rides very tuned. And so a lot of those builders, you know, use that fork just because it rides amazing.
So I do want to talk about wheels, because it seems like Velo News, I think, today online had 51 pictures of wheels that are at the tour, all carbon wheels. And it's like it's so mind boggling what has happened with aftermarket wheels. I think when people think of most companies, they think of just road. But you also have a downhill mountain bike wheel.
We do. Having first in the bike industry is pretty rare. And so, you know, when given the opportunity to potentially do a downhill wheel, I was excited because it was one of the few firsts that are left. But it also was a great example of how strong our XC and all mountain wheels are. And so we didn't really expect to develop much of a downhill market. It was more of a way for us to be able to kind of show the wheels perform in the most abusive environments. And hopefully that would lead a lot of confidence into people's decision to buy an XC or an AM wheel. You know, ironically, we're selling a lot of DH wheels, which we're thrilled about. But, you know, it's a really, you know, interesting product as far as carbon on the dirt. And it requires the carbon to be done very well and processed accurately. And if it's not, then there are some opportunities for a negative experience. And so it'll be interesting to watch how mountains accept it over the next couple of years. But when it's done correctly, it's an incredible performance and more importantly, just ride benefit that you just don't get from an aluminum wheel set. And people that ride them will immediately come back and not want to talk weight. They just want to talk about how amazing they ride.
Are they considerably lighter?
Yeah, well, I mean, within reference, you know, like our DH rim weighs about 450 grams, which, you know, there are other wide rims out there at that weight, but they're not really rated for DH. If you compare it against similar stiffness or somewhat similar performance in aluminum, you're looking at a 690 gram rim.
Oh, I see.
In that case, it's a huge difference.
Yeah, that's big.
You know, with our XC product, you're kind of comparing it with some of these super light stands wheels, which, you know, arguably you could build lighter. But the reality is the ride performance of the carbon at that weight, where we're kind of apples to apples in weight, the ride characteristics are nowhere near each other.
So let's talk about just the carbon itself for a second. It's obviously it's exploded as far as our entire industry is concerned. What makes carbon such a good material for all of these different products, stems and bars and forks and wheels and frames and seat posts?
You know, to me, I guess it's just a phenomenal material for bikes. It rewards all the right components, if you will. You know, it rides really well. It's light. It's stiff. But in some way, you know, it provides this vibration or kind of harmonic dampening to the ride experience, which for me on the mountain side is even greater because the terrain's so rough. So, you know, it kind of just rewards every aspect of cycling, and all your parts on your bike, you want to be as light as possible, but as stiff and perform as clean as possible and have a lively feel, but be smooth. And, you know, carbon kind of accomplishes all those things. So it's just a great bike material.
Do you think the cost will start coming down as the market expands for carbon?
Well, I think there's two ways to value carbon going forward. And that's, if you're buying a really high-end carbon part, chances are the life of that carbon part are going to be twice to two to three times, you know, whatever that multiplier is to an aluminum part. So there's a cost savings there in the fact that you can buy something and use it for a longer period of time and not see the degradation of the performance of the part because the fatigue of carbon is so much better than aluminum.
Okay.
So you get, and if you get a cost savings there that not a lot of people realize, but then you also get, you know, some cost savings as you get, you know, more and more into the market and people get smarter about how they make it. But I don't see the cost of carbon itself coming down a whole lot. And until people find cheaper ways to process it, it's a very labor intensive product. And so I don't know that you'll see big cost savings. But generally, when you see cost savings on carbon, you're costing yourself quality of process. And that's not always a good thing. So.
Right. Let me take a second to remind our listeners we're speaking with Jason Shears, who is the head of NV. Do you call yourself just NV Composites or it's just NV?
Oh, we go by both now at this point. But, I mean, technically we're NV Composites.
Yeah. So do you see any future for carbon in the long-distance touring market? I mean, you know, right now we're pretty much telling people, well, carbon doesn't do well on a side load. So putting racks and panniers on the bike is probably not a good idea. But I also know that a lot of our customers do a lot of long-distance touring. So I'm just wondering, do you see a use for carbon in touring at some point?
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen a bike that didn't like carbon yet. So, I mean, anybody that's riding a bike and has a relationship with that bike and spends a lot of time on it, there's no part of that bike that's not going to get benefited by having it made out of carbon. And so even those style bikes where you have all these attachment points and have different loads can be engineered too. That's not a problem. It's more of just, I think it's just kind of natural saturation. It'll end up there just like it will everywhere else. And I think you'll see a lot of it moving into BMX as well and some, you know, into kids bikes. It's, you know, with a lot of the big companies now are speccing carbon hoops on most of their high end stuff. You know, Cannondale, you know, went too deep this year. Their top two models have carbon wheel stock. So I think you'll see it become more of a norm. And when that happens, it kind of saturates outwards. So.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, actually, because we get asked that question a lot, you know, and right now I'm not comfortable telling somebody to put a, you know, 40 pounds of panniers on the back of his carbon fiber bike.
No, I think it had to be designed that way.
Yep.
I think to get the best performance out of it, it had to be intentional.
So I have one more question about your road wheels, and that is the braking surface, because a lot of people think that carbon wheels don't stop well, which for the most part might be true, but you've done something special to your carbon rims.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people think carbon doesn't stop well because they have an experience that has told them that carbon doesn't stop well. But so carbon always has been a little challenged that way. And then, you know, I think a lot of people kind of figured out dry braking, but wet braking was still always an issue. And, you know, so for us, you know, dealing with brakes on carbon wheels is a real challenge because it's, you know, destructive to the actual material and the amount of heat it builds. So you're kind of always balancing wet and, you know, modulation and heat and whatnot. So what I think you're seeing now is the pad makers have got a lot better. I mean, the pads we're using now are better than any pad that I've ever tested, you know, in my past. And then for us as a manufacturer, we felt like you needed to give something, you know, that worked in conjunction with a good pad. And so we used roughened surfaces. They're actually texturized surfaces that we found work great for gating water when it's wet, but also giving you really affirmative modulation when it's dry. And so far, you know, everybody that's used the newest wheels we've made have come back with a very, very positive response to the braking, which is an odd thing for them to see as a high level in wheels, but at the same time, it just kind of reaffirms that they really need it. So.
Got it. Okay, well, I remember you said every pair of wheels comes with its own brake pads.
Yeah, we spent a fair amount of time optimizing that. So we were dealing with brake heat issues, like I was just saying, and then, you know, all the way down to the wear characteristics of the pad. And what we found with this one is the manufacturer was willing to work with us. We went through several different iterations and different compositions from cork, you know, through different compounds of rubber and you know, the compound that we ended up with was the one that worked best, so we're pretty thrilled with it.
Now, do you make full wheel sets, or are you making just rims?
We do. Well, we just manufacture rims, and then we build everything on either a DT or Chris King hub.
Got it.
Using DT Aerolite spokes. We do offer full wheel sets.
So the last thing I want to talk about is Interbike. You going to be introducing anything new that you can talk to us about?
No.
No, you can't talk to us, or no, you're not introducing anything new?
Well, if I say I'm introducing something new, then I'm committing myself to it. So
that's true.
The answer is probably no on both, and then maybe something will show up.
Well, Jason, I really appreciate you talking with me this evening and telling us about Envy. So would you please let our listeners know how they can get to your website and learn about your company, too?
Absolutely. You can reach us at www.envycomposites.com, and that's spelled E-N-V-E. And, you know, all of our products are listed on the website. We try to be as intuitive as we can on there, but if for any reason it's not enough, you're always welcome to call the office as well. And those numbers are listed on the website, including the toll-free number. So we intend to be the most approachable you talk to as well. So anyone's welcome to call.
Well, thanks so much, and have a great rest of your summer, and we'll see you at Interbike.
Sounds great.
All right. Bye-bye, Jason.
Bye. Jason Shears of Envy Composites joined us from
Ogden, Utah.
Are you ready to be assimilated like the Borg?
What does that mean?
He says carbon is going to eventually infuse everything.
Carbon has a lot of good qualities. And I think, you know, if they are able to figure out how to make it more, you know, price friendly in a lot of applications, it's lighter, it's very strong. It certainly has it all over aluminum, in my opinion.
Yeah.
As far as, is it going to replace steel and titanium? Probably not, but I think it's another good, I mean, those are the three materials we use, you know.
Well, it makes a good point. If it's designed for the purpose,
right,
carbon can do just as well as anything else. And I think that's been the holdup in a lot of cases, is that there haven't been carbon bikes designed to handle a touring load.
Right.
Not to say it couldn't be done.
Although I think Craig is, Calfee is working on that, as far as I know. Of course, he's Mr. Innovator, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well,
maybe your next bike will be a carbon fiber bike?
I highly doubt it.
Aha. Uh-huh.
But it's exciting to hear about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he, you know, I really enjoyed talking to him when I was at press camp, and I enjoy talking to him tonight.
Well, and this is really kind of a microcosm of what's going on with American manufacturing in general now, is that the manufacturing that's coming back home to the U.S. is the high-tech stuff.
Which is very cool.
You know, we're done with the big, bulky, dirty type of steel making, and I mean, we still do that, but more of the manufacturing that we're doing now is this kind of stuff that that Envy is doing, which is the very high-tech, very precise stuff that can really be done more cheaply here than other parts of the world.
And so, done right.
Yeah. Glad exactly. to see it. Glad
Me
to see
too.
It.
Me too.
Hey, we've got to scoot out
okay.
of here. No matter what material you're on, we encourage you to ride this week.
Yes.
And maybe you'll ride across left. Indiana.
Maybe you will ride across Indiana July 21st. That's a week from tonight.
Yeah.
Yep.
Until then, be safe. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.